Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and joining me tonight are Aaron White. Say hello. And Hugh Kenneth David. Say hello.
Hello.
And tonight's topic of discussion is homicide, life on the street. This is a crime show that ran on NBC from 1993, January of 93, until the spring of 99. It ran for seven seasons. It was wrapped up in a TV movie the following season in early 2000. It does, however, hold a distinction of having one of the shortest considered full seasons in American broadcast history. But we'll get to that later. It is about the homicide division of the Baltimore Police Department. It's based on a book, Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, by Baltimore Sun-Times journalist David Simon, who would later go on to create The Wire. This series, however, was adapted for television, but only the first episode by Paul Attanasio, but was mainly run, at least early on, by Tom Fontana and Barry Levinson. And if you're thinking, well, shit, that's a pretty good group of people, yeah, you should look at who else wrote the show and who else directed the show. And we'll get into that as we go on. But, you know, I think I'll start with you first, Hugh. How did you first come to homicide?
So I've been watching NYPD Blue and ER on UK TV, which obviously, you know, is quite groundbreaking in the way they did television. And I was able to persuade a lot of friends to watch them, but I'd heard of Homicide, but it hadn't just yet crossed over. The moment it was bought by a UK channel, which was Channel 4, and it was aired, I was on it. It was my first few years teaching. I was obsessed with the book. I'd read I still have my English paperback copy, which is like, I think, the year after the American publication. And I'd read it cover to cover more than once. And I could not believe we were getting a TV show. And so it debuted at 10 p.m. on Thursday nights. And even though I had to go to work the next day as a teacher, I was up every night watching it, even when it got pushed back later on to an even later slot, because it wasn't very popular. And I think they aired as far as season 5, whichever season is the one that begins with the school shootout is the one that they aired everything except the shootout, and I never saw it until years later on DVD. I was in it from the start. You know, still think the book is an amazing piece of, you know, American nonfiction. Yeah. So that's how I got into the show.
So what about you, Aaron? How did you get into the show?
It would be after I watched The Wire, you started getting on me to watch this specifically. basically what order I should watch David Simon. And it's not streaming anywhere. And it's also not available for digital purchase here anywhere. And so it just kept getting pushed back. I think I found the pilot somewhere, and then I watched the pilot, and I was like, okay, I have to see this. And so eventually I just broke down and bought the whole set on DVD because it's still the cheapest way to get it. But I bought that on the strength of the pilot, and then watched through that, gosh, at the end of the summer this year, I think, last year. I'm still a relative newbie, all things considered, but.
Well, with me, well, welcome to the club, but with me, I was there from the start. It came on after the Super Bowl. Now, I do not watch football as a rule, especially the pro game. This time I watched the Super Bowl only because, even though I was a kid, I knew that for sporting events like that, as soon as the event was over, they'd switch right to the show, and I didn't want to miss it. I knew they said at 10 p.m. after the Super Bowl, and I'm thinking to myself, bullshit, this is football. They're gonna, it's gonna end at like, it's gonna start at like 10:20 or 10:30 or 10:45, and sure enough, it did start at an odd time. So I ended up having to watch part of a football game, or at least kind of watch it, not really, but you know, I was kind of had it on mute, and I was sitting there waiting. I think I was reading a book, looking over every like 10 seconds, making sure, because I'd seen the ads for this show for months, and I was really interested. You know, it said who it was from. You know, Barry Levinson was a big director. I liked Rain Man. I liked some of his other stuff. And so I was very curious about this show. And I was there from the start, and I watched it all the way to the end. I absolutely adored this show. It was like nothing else on TV. And it still isn't like much else on TV, particularly broadcast TV. Mm-hmm. The fact that this thing lasted 7 seasons, honestly, is in part to the fact that then NBC president Warren Littlefield truly loved the show. But even the president of the network couldn't force the issue to an 8th season, and he had to, from what I understand, call in a favor or two with the money guys to get them the money to do the movie to wrap the storylines up. So I'll actually thank Warren Littlefield for that. That's actually something I'll appreciate him for. I said earlier, and this is not one of the questions that I asked, but it is something that I want to say. You know, the credit is that it said created by Paul Attanasio, but that's always been a topic of discussion among Homicide fans and historians, and it's because Tom Fontana really was the driving creative force behind much of the show, along with James Yoshimura, Anya Epstein, Henry Brommel, and David Simon himself, particularly Yoshimura and Simon in later seasons, and Tom Fontana in the early season. And in some of the commentary on the DVDs, Yoshimura and I believe it's Eric Overmeyer said, oh yeah, no, They just won't give him the credit, but Attanasio did a pass of the draft and really shouldn't get credit, or at least shouldn't get full credit. This was really Tom and James' show, so you know, I think that's
kind of
interesting.
Like,
I'd like to hear more, but you know, I'm sure there's big WGA, you know, Writers Guild of America reasons for why the credits are what they are. But, yeah, as you were going to say, Aaron?
It's kind of like Mindhunter. That's Fincher's baby, but somebody adapted the first few chapters of the book, and they got the created by credit for the same basic reason, even though they only wrote, like, one episode, and they weren't involved at all after that, and it was done at the behest of other people. So
yeah, it was Joel Penhall
kind of
got the credit,
way that
though it was Fincher that was in charge of the show, and it was based on the guy's book. Yeah. Yeah, so anything to add to that, Hugh? Anything that you've heard?
No. I mean, you guys have covered that very, very well. And it is just one of those things, you know, it's not the first, it's in one in television, it's not the last one. I think the proof of it is in the pudding. We all, you know, Attanasio had, if memory serves, had he done Quiz Show by then? I can't remember, but his name was definitely a name they could
Quiz
throw around.
Quiz Show
the
was 94, this was 93, so he was coming up.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so I feel like it was a name that they could throw around alongside Levinson as being, you know, cinema credentials that they could sell the TV on when, as we all know, you know, it's pure television in the best sense.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so there's a lot of stuff I want to ask. But the thing is I'll ask the question that I always seem to ask here, and that is, what are the themes of this show?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go to you, Aaron. What are the themes of this show?
Oh. How do I put this? We're coming into the first true modern era of television here. We're coming out of Twin Peaks. We're coming into Homicide and X-Files and NYPD Blue and ER and all of these shows that really lay the groundwork for what comes next. And so what we're dealing with here is the first truly, in my mind, I know I'm going to get pushback. Someone's going to say Hill Street Blues, whatever. This is a like clear-eyed television show about police and the way they work. This is not a white hat, black cat show. This is not all cops are good all the time and everybody on the street is horrible. This is very much we're dealing in shades of gray, and sometimes the criminal is doing more good than the cops. And the cops have to deal with that too. And I don't know exactly, like, to see the Law and Order crossover episodes are really something else. Because even though they all have the same characters, and they all have the same basic storyline because it's a crossover episode.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you weren't told which was which, you would know which was which because Law and Order is much more classic. It's so much more, hey, the cops are good guys. The lawyers are good guys. Let's get this done. And Homicide is like, pull back the rug. And it's like, wait a second. So I don't know how to boil that down into a theme other than maybe you always have to question what's in front of you, even if you're used to them wearing a white hat.
So, Hugh?
Oh, wow. Well, I've got my notes from when you send us the questions because I always cut and paste them into a document and write out notes. I've got heightened reality and I've got ordinary people doing extraordinary things. I've got race in America. I've got, what was the other thing I've got? How do I put this? One of the great illusions that has been fostered abroad about the United States is that it was, for many years at least, is the notion that it was classless, particularly in comparison to England.
Mm.
And one of the things I enjoyed about both NYPD Blue and Homicide is they are so, so grounded in the realities that they are, that they're portraying, that class is actually hugely important. And they both embrace, you know, different ways of looking at it, but it's important to both shows. And the thing about Homicide is it's even more realistic and complex in its understanding of race and class. And I think I would argue that the modern phrase, the academic phrase, intersectionality applies. Right, the drama in the show is never, as you just said, is never simplistic. You know, it's never black and white. It is always, always, always nuanced and leans towards the humanist. And every once in a while, it goes even further. It leans towards self-reflective and self-referential in the best dramatic sense. You know, drama, the writing and the production issues like coming through in dialogue and pithy references, and you know, it's just so grown up and nuanced. It leaves everything else behind in the dust, and that's why I think you're absolutely right to say, yeah, forget Hill Street, because Hill Street moves the needle on the clock forward in terms of cinematic technique and in terms of dialogue and in terms of character, but it doesn't. And it is nuanced on the small scale of what it's trying to do, but this is nuanced in a way. Fontana somehow achieves the impossible and brings across the Dickensian side of who Simon is. I've said for years that Simon is the modern Charles Dickens for America, right? That's who he is. He's a journalist who tried to comment on reality and get and create reform, who then turned to fiction because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't working. And has had greater influence that way. And I feel like, On the Corner in particular, even more than Homicide is as a book, is, you know, the ultimate in Dickensian writing. And I just think somehow Fontana and his team nailed it.
Yeah. Well, that says it. Now, another question that wasn't exactly on the prep work, but it's more of a comment. I want to get your guys' impressions, but for those who are coming to tonight's show, not having seen this show, here's another reason why I was interested as a kid. This was a TV show that was going to have in its cast Daniel Baldwin, Richard Belzer, Andre Brower, Clark Johnson, Yaphet Kotto, Melissa Leo, John Polito, Kyle Secor, and Ned Beatty as its original cast. Now, you know, Kyle Secor wasn't really known. Andre Brower was known. He was up and coming. Clark Johnson had been around, but he was up and coming. Same with Melissa Leo. I knew of her because I had a family that watched a soap opera she'd been on. These were huge gets for a show, and you know, since then they would add names like Reed Diamond, Michelle Forbes, Pierre Garrity, John Seta, Michelle, Giancarlo Esposito, Zelko Ivanek had a recurring role as Danvers, the district attorney. You know, this was not a show that, you know, yeah, people talked about, you know, oh, it doesn't look as physically polished as other shows. But that's because they weren't going for gloss. You know, Aaron mentioned it with the Law and Order crossovers. But, you know, give me the roughness of Homicide's look, as long as I get cast scripts and direction like this. I mean, and again, I've got a list here. Just for an example, that first season was directed by Barry Levinson, Martin Campbell, Michael Lehman, Nick Gomez, Bruce Paltrow, Alan Taylor, Peter Markle, and the series then cinematographer Wayne Ewing, who was not asked to return after that first season because he was considered way too wild. However, he did set the tone in terms of you know, some very inventive camera work. But I'm wondering if you guys remember this. I think it was maybe the second or third episode. Do you remember that jump cut where there's the two detectives coming up the alley in broad daylight? See the jump cut. But the jump cut I'm thinking of is where it's not just a little one like you're used to, where it's maybe like two or three frames, but you see them like up at the corner, then you see them in the middle of the screen, and then you see them right there by the body. It's like one, two, and you're like, whoa. You know, jump cuts were not unknown. They were very, TV. And Homicide had used them previously, but when I saw that thing, I was like, wait, what the fuck did I just see? I remember my my parents were watching it with me, and they were like, oh, did they just jump through, like, a minute of time? You know, this is a show that really played with form and content and its relationships. And, you know, you look through the cast. I mean, they had great guest actresses. Gwen Verdon comes to mind. One of the season finales was directed by Catherine Bigelow. And I know this is a bit of a digression, but has there ever been a show on American network television that's had a stable of actors and directors this accomplished? I don't know.
Not so cool.
So
definitely not.
I would argue. Okay, so I hold the weird distinction of having written what were the only reviews of the USBVs on the net in England for a website that is now long gone. And it's weird because I was looking back at my review of the first, well, so the DVD set of seasons 1 and 2, right? And it's funny, so much of what you've said so far, guys, is there, right? Like, I wrote this down back must be 15 years ago now. But I did make the point, like, my opening made the point that I think one of the most relevant sort of stepping stones in terms of a shifting from the way TV was made to the way TV got made and the bringing in of cinema, feature film elements and feature film quality from actors and directors. I do still think Miami Vice and Crime Story stand really tall in this area. I think if Michael Mann hadn't done what he did using the people that he did, and you can look at he gave people who were having hard time.
I'll also throw in Wise Guy. I have to throw in Wise Guy as a third.
Absolutely. All three of those. And I think that, but I think in terms of actors and directors, when you go back now and you look at Miami Vice and you realize that you saw, Benicio del Toro when he was coming up and Liam Neeson when he was coming up, you know, and just the list is insane when you start going back to those four seasons, but then also the directors, and sometimes they're not movie directors. It's not the people on the way up. It's the people who are struggling and get a boost in the arm because of Miami Vice. So I'm thinking like Abel Ferrara, right? You know, and Abel Ferrara's work on the Crime Story pilot, I still think is one of the best things he's ever done. You know, he pushed the limits of what he's been
doing. If you want my opinion,
far.
It might be the best thing he's ever done. But I know Bad Lieutenant fans will kill me for that.
Yeah, true. They will, but I'm with you on this.
Just directing stables, you have Twin Peaks. But you don't have the cast. Like, the cast were, they were kids. They were unknowns. And so it is like when you look at the connection of the two, it's just.
Yeah.
And like, X-Files had the actors, but they didn't have that stable of directors.
No, exactly. Yeah. A lot of their directors became famous because of the show.
St. Elsewhere also had the actors.
Agreed.
Yep. And St. Elsewhere, let's not forget, St. Elsewhere was a Tom Fontana thing. You know, Brandon Falsey had those two had created it. They would go on, of course, to create Northern Exposure. But when they were shunted aside after season one, Tom Fontana took over. And that's when the show became fun. I'm not saying that season one of St. Elsewhere is not fun, but that's when St. Elsewhere became the St. Elsewhere that we think of it as. But let's also, you know, because I just mentioned him, Bruce Paltrow was not a nobody St. Elsewhere. You know, Tom Fontana deserves all the credit, but let's not forget Paltrow. He really did some great work there. But, But yeah, I mean, St. Elsewhere and Homicide, there's definite connections there. I mean, a lot of the people that Noreen Fontana brought a lot of people over there, a lot of people when Levinson was saying, hey, how do we do a TV show? I know how to do movies. Fontana was like, well, I did St. Elsewhere, so let me get some of these people. I know this lady. I know this guy. You know, they need a job. They're great. And next thing you know, boom, one of the classic shows has been made.
Yeah, and while we are focusing on the other avenues of television cinema, I do want to mention the fact that for me at the time, something I think I'd only seen on Michael Mann was that whole business of casting a stand-up in a role that they would then absolutely inhabit and excel. Apparently Levinson saw Belsaw on TV and thought, I wonder what he'd be like if he was a cop. And thus we get Munch, who is one of the all-time
greats. And the answer is
great.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Well, absolutely
I am
awesome
not Montel
character.
Williams. I am not Montel Williams.
Yes, literally one of the greatest lines ever.
Well, they use Montel Williams a few times because, John Polito's character, Crosetti, he said, you mean a guy from Baltimore has his own TV show? Yeah, a talk show.
Yeah, it's
a
so
talk
funny.
Show. And it's popular? Ain't that a
so
thing?
yeah, it's so funny. So funny.
But yeah, while we're speaking of that, I can tell this is going to go a little longer than I wanted because of this. But I had mentioned the show having an unusual second season. The first season has 9 episodes. The second season has 4, which is essentially the back order for the first season. They put it together on DVD as the first and second seasons. That second season also has David Simon's very first screenplay for television, Bop Gun, which had Robin Williams in it.
Folks. The biggest movie star in the world.
Who did the show because of his great respect for his buddy Barry Levinson. As on the strength of the buzz around Homicide and the Bop Gun script that had been floating around, David Mills, who I believe, without double checking it right now, had co-written Bop Gun with Simon. He'd of course gone over and worked at NYPD Blue. And Simon actually ended up writing an episode of NYPD Blue. And the story I've read is that Bochco and Milch said, hey, we'd like to have you. And he said, okay, but we want you as a writer. And you'll just get an idea once in a while and you'll write it up. And he was like, yeah, but I think I'd kind of be interested in, learning the business. I'm a journalist. I like investigating things and learning things. He was not at the time thinking about becoming a TV writer and producer full time. He just thought it was interesting and he wanted to learn more. So Tom Fontana said, I heard that they're offering you a job over at NYPD Blue. How would you like me to teach you the business here? And you can keep an eye on the show that's based on your book. And the rest is history. And David Simon to this day says almost everything he knows about television he owes to Tom Fontana and, quote, the fine folks at Homicide. So I think that's kind of cool,
it's just amazing how, I think it says it all that one producer wanted to just make him fit into the mold of how writers were treated at the industry at the time, and the other one was like, hey, we do things differently here.
Yeah, and so, you know, and the thing is, as Simon took more control of the show, it definitely became a different thing. You know, it definitely became a different thing. You know, because from season, I mean, those first two seasons, those first 13 episodes, are really something special. But it's that third season that I think always gets pointed to as where Homicide became Homicide, and that's where, you know, you really started to see Epstein, Brommel, who was only there for a couple of seasons, and Simon and Yoshimura really start to take over with Fontaine as the guiding hand and become the show that, well, at least some of us know and love. This is one of those great unknown shows, unfortunately. But yes, so, you know, I will actually get this question to you, Hugh, and I will ask this. Who's your favorite character on the show?
Oh, God. You're asking me that was one of the greatest ensembles in television history.
Oh, yeah, I know.
do I have to do this? Okay, let's see. Normally, like, if you'd asked me this in the 90s, I would have said Frank Pebbleson right off the bat, right? You know, Braga was just amazing. And I'd seen, I mean, not only have I had I seen, I have seen Glory so many times, and he's so good in that.
Oh, what a
And I'd also, yeah, I mean, I teach it when I can, And, I've seen, weirdly, I have seen the Kojak revival movies, which he was part of as well, because he plays a New York cop in those. Which were really quite gritty. They were put together by the production team behind The Equalizer. So they were very much like the, unlike the TV series version of Kojak, which was much more of a, you know, typical 70s production, the original three-part pilot that was a one-off at the time and then, you know, became a pilot. That was shot on location and that was incredibly gritty. It felt like a return to that. Anyway, Braga was great. But over the years, and especially when I went back to all the DVDs to review them originally, Giardello is just immense, an immense character. And Cotto does so much with it, and there is so much subtlety. And I mean, he was always great. This guy, you know, I mean, Blue Collar, Alien, you know, across 110th Street. I mean, you know, do you know what I mean? We all knew who he was, and he was huge, but. And that was a big retraction, but the work he got to do, working with the same character week in, week out, and the things they gave him a chance to do, and then later on he got to write a storyline, you know, and they let him because he knew the character inside out, and they understood that he had something to say with the character. I mean, you know, first time I can remember seeing an episode about colorism on American Women.
I was just going to say, are you mentioning? I was wondering if you were getting to that. Yep, that was amazing when I saw that because you know I was aware of that, but I'd never seen it on TV before, and I was like, wait, what? Are they actually showing this on TV? Not that I was horrified, I was just astounded that someone had the balls to do it finally.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I think when he came along, even though he looked on paper, he was superficially your classic TV cop. I think Reed Diamond did really good things with Kellerman. I think Kellerman and Lewis
especially
was a
early
really
on.
Interesting guy. I think
especially
there
early
really,
on and then right at the end.
Yeah. And then I think the other two who. Because obviously there were characters who left, you know, and not everyone sticks around. But in terms of the long run, I think it's got to be Lewis and Munch, right? You know, just interesting, unusual characters. Lewis, because he's just so, Johnson makes him just so real and local and the heart of the show in many ways, right? You know, it's Brog.
Him and that hat, and he just wants to own a bar and... Stay out of trouble, and yet that shit always seems to find him.
Yeah, exactly. And if Pembleton is the brain, Lewis is the heart, and that was clear throughout the entire series. And Munch is Munch, man. Munch is just an icon, right?
Munch is fucking Loki. Munch is a mischief maker. So, he's a troublemaker, but ultimately he's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So I'm, but also I love the irony. I love the idea of a 60s hippie gone cop. I think I think Fontana and the team were onto something long before everybody was talking about boomer generation policy.
Well, I mean, literally, remember they had that episode where, there was an art exhibit across from the police station. and sure enough, one of the paintings one of the things on exhibit was a touched up photo of Munch from the 60s, and he was nude.
Yeah, it's so funny.
And I remember Lewis saying, "So, the little Munchkins out across the street. What? Yeah, I've seen it. I wish I hadn't seen it, but it's there, and all it's not so glory." and you get to see Munch go over across the street, and he just kind of stares at the wall, and you know what he's looking at, and he's just like, "Yeah, damn it."
What he's looking at, because he's blocking it in the shot.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's so careful.
Because you can see his face on the wall, but you can't see anything else.
Yeah. No, so I think, I mean, those are the kind of, I mean, like, I don't want to pick favorites, man. It's like a family. But, you know, if you're going to, but you're pushing me, those are the people. Jodelo's at the top of the list now. Second, solid, spoken by Pemble.
Mm-hmm. So what about
you, Larry? Do you guys know the thing, the videos, what's it called? Do you guys know the website Cameo, where you can get people can pay actors to send you a personalized video?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so a friend of mine during lockdown for my 50th birthday, bought me he got Reed Diamond to make me one.
Oh,
like,
nice.
And I wasn't expecting it. It was out of the blue. It was lovely. But the best thing was that apparently Reed Diamond couldn't deliver it on time for my birthday because he was out shooting, and he got back and he was emailing my friend and saying, "I'm so sorry, I'll do something special. Don't worry about the cost. It'll be a bit longer. It'll be a longer one." And so I've got him getting out a guitar halfway through and wishing me happy birthday and singing me a song. Wishing me happy birthday. So that may have increased my Kellerman on the in terms of where he sits on the list.
I love it.
Yeah.
So what about you, Aaron? Who's your favorite?
I'll try to narrow it down a little more than Hugh did, but I'm still not gonna give you one.
I don't think with this show you can.
Is Pembleton is Pembleton. Like he's the Rock. Munch and again Lewis. I think those three. If as Hugh says, and I agree, if Pembleton's the brain and Lewis is the heart, then Munch is the soul of this show. have to get the three parts of the human psyche together here now. So.
So what? So who else would you have? Just those three then?
I think I can narrow it down to those. Everybody's great. I have to admit that Kellerman is my least favorite character on the show.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But I also didn't get a cameo from Reed Diamond. But you know what? I'm gonna give a special shout out, and I'm blanking on the kid's name at the moment. But the video, the AR nerd who shows up.
Max Brody
was brilliant.
Brody.
You know, honestly, I was kind of surprised that you didn't list one of the ladies, like Melissa Leo or.
I do love Melissa Leo too, but I was trying to have a shorter list, get closer to that you know, but we just keep proving how impossible that is in this show.
Yeah, yeah. I think
we haven't even mentioned Bayless yet.
Yeah, exactly. I think the other thing about Leo is, you know, she left for very, very specific reasons. And much as I love her, whenever I rewatch the show, I really feel like she's being underwritten in some years, especially as the show goes on.
That's what I said to Adam. One of my biggest issues with season 5 is that they really lost track of how to write her.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a real shame.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that. And I will co-sign on everything you guys have said. But I'll add in that I also was really fond of Al's son, of Mike Giardello, played by Giancarlo Esposito,
mm-hmm.
in the final season.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
had the show
mm-hmm.
gone on another season or two, he would be spoken of in similar terms to the other characters that we're talking about. I don't know if any character on the show had as big a redemptive arc as Garrity did, you know, coming as he did a complete coward and drunk and becoming something quite other by the end of it. And
mm-hmm.
having to struggle through to get that. Again, that's a testament to the writing and the acting in this show. But now I'm going to ask, and I'll go to you, Aaron. What were your favorite storylines in this show?
So obviously, Idina, that really takes up the first 3 seasons, like, as far as the major arc goes.
The young girl that gets murdered, that's Bayless's first case,
mm-hmm.
and never quite solves it.
That's Tim's legacy throughout the series, so that
mm-hmm.
can't be undersold.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, the Steve Buscemi arc where Melissa Leo and Munch and who's the other one? Beatty's character get shot.
Olander.
That's a really and then all of season 4 had several 2-part episodes and
mm-hmm.
the arc
mm-hmm.
like season 4 in some ways is not as great as season 3. In some ways it's greater. I do think that it's a little more connected than any of the other material at the end. And there's just so many just great 2- and 3-parters throughout that season. The sniper episode
mm-hmm.
come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
The arsonist mm-hmm. that brings Kellerman in.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which was a good episode.
Yeah.
But it was a good story.
Yes, it was a great story.
I remember you actually saying, "Oh, I like this Kellerman guy. Is he gonna? He's gonna stick around for a while." I was like, "Yep," and I was that I think was probably the peak for you with him. I do go to that, but you know. I'm trying to think. There, you know, the storyline that opens up the 6th season, where it's the 3-part story about the prominent African American family with James Earl Jones, Lynn Whitfield, and
great one too.
And oh my gosh, I just lost his name, and I've actually met the guy. But yeah, as the son, amazing work, you know, amazing stuff there. The stuff about the priests,
mm-hmm.
and Honestly, I really did like the stuff that was just, you know, I think this is why you made a good point about Al Giardino. Al's ongoing trouble with the brass, that was always excellent. And that really helped highlight the bullshit in the police department and the racism of the city.
Jeffrey Wright was the son in that, right?
That was
it was Jeffrey Wright. That was a great set of episodes. But you know, there's just so many great stories on this. I actually, you know, how I even liked the little romance that Bolander had in season two with the other cellist. I thought that was nice.
Sweet.
So, Hugh, what about you? What are some of your favorite stories from the show?
You guys are gonna laugh because everything Aaron said is on my list. like it's all there.
Did I tell you I read your article?
No, you didn't. I mean, Adina Watson is the first one, and first and last, always, right? It's the basis of so much in the show. Because I'm a Pembleton fan, I loved season five where he goes, or six where he goes through the caffeine pill addiction. Season five, right? And then he ends up with the brain aneurysm. I just loved the way it was seeded.
That was the end of season. That was the end of season four that he has the aneurysm.
Four.
In season five, that they show him
the
coming back
itself,
from it.
Yeah,
that's it, right? So, because the thing was, I felt like that was seeded in so early on, because there's all this talk in the first season of his obsession with coffee, caffeine. You know, there's that line where he says something like. He's talking to Bayless about the fact that Bayless still cares about something. He says, I haven't got it. He's talking to Leo's character, and he's saying I don't have the ability to think or care anymore. It's just it's all in the caffeine. I'm just running on caffeine. And so it was always like a thing that was just in the background, and we just built it up, and then suddenly bang, it's there, you know?
It's things like that, little character moments that make the show.
Exactly. Lewis, Kellerman, and Mahoney, I think that entire arc that lasted, you know, quite a while and has repercussions, you know, that was the kind of thing that every show sort of tries to do and does, but, you know, and think they've done it well, but, you know, nobody does it like Homicide, right? Nobody. But also, it's not just the big arcs. I mean, it's also, like, as you guys were saying, individual episodes. I mean, Three Men and Adina is the gold standard for, you know, a certain for kind of chamber drama television, right? One episode, Three Men, one case.
Yeah,
right?
And it won Tom Fantana the Emmy.
Yeah. And if memory serves, it was it John McNaughton or Martin Campbell who directed that one? I think it was McNaughton, wasn't it?
You know, I'm gonna double check that right now. I'm going to double check that right now. I do think it was Martin Campbell, but I'm going to have to be sure.
But again, you know, movie technique being brought into television.
Yep, it was Martin Campbell.
And there you go, Campbell. I mean, literally, there's a reason they give that man a global billion-dollar franchise to reboot every now and then, right? But the thing is, Campbell started out in television. You know, Campbell used to direct episodes of one of my favorite cop shows as a kid here in England, The Professionals. You know, it's really weird just watching it. It was just so weird watching it come full circle and watching him go from gritty but, you know, deliberately action movie style stuff here in England to, you know, working his way through films in the 80s. And then he gets to America and he's doing other things and he's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll come and do this. And he's like, yeah, okay, I get to do this.
Yeah, well, don't forget, this is the guy that did one of the Zorro movies, but he also did, you know, a James Bond movie, and he also did one of the all-time great miniseries in Edge of Darkness.
Precisely. Edge of Darkness is just, you know, I mean, Campbell's, you know, people, we don't praise him enough. We don't talk about him enough. Do you know what I mean? But again, Bob Gunn, which is just heartbreaking. I will never forget the, you know, him taking offense with the way the cops are talking about the case in the day. That's one of the most brilliant scenes ever. And, but then to top it all, it's capped by DiBello saying to him, you know, both apologizing and saying, you need to understand what we do. You know,
yeah.
Which is just, yeah. Chrisetti,
you know, this,
I mean,
this, all
episode.
This discussion, you know, the stuff what you're just saying right here, Hugh, and all this discussion that we're having, you know, we've talked about longer storylines, but, you know, there's those, a lot of, Homicide was a show with ongoing stories, but it was also still somewhat episodic. And a lot of the most powerful moments and stories were things like, you know, Bob Gunn, where it was just one episode. You know, I mean, there is, you know, A Doll's Eyes, where you have Marsha Gay Harden as a woman who cannot quite come to terms with the fact that her son is brain dead. There's Every Mother's Child, where there's this scene of these two women waiting. One of them is the mother of the killer. The other one is the mother of the victim. And there's this moment where
that
they realize who they are. And, oh, my Lord.
Here's the thing, right? I cannot remember. And I watched it every week as well. I cannot remember a whole individual case from NYPD Blue. I can remember, like, moments, characters, scenes. But because of so many reasons, I can't remember a thing. Whereas here, I'm like, you know, what is this, nearly 30 years later? And I'm just going bang, bang, bang. I mean, that's the difference right there, you know.
I'm going to be honest. I think it's because we have better characters here.
Yeah, it was everything. It's better characters, better writing, better acting, better, and the reality of the direction. I mean, I know we're effectively answering your usual question of, is this a triumph of? But the thing is that NYPD Blue never felt like New York, because half of it was shot in L.A. and it was too sunny. You know, they only
And this definitely felt like Baltimore. And, you know, that's another thing I thought was really cool about the show, is everything was set in New York or L.A. Occasionally you'd have Chicago or Boston, you know, or some nebulous, you know, southern town. You know, there were the Golden Girls down in Miami. Or, you know, you had your soap opera set in Midwestern towns or East Coast towns or some, you know, place on the West Coast maybe, but nothing real. This was an unusual to have it in Baltimore, you know.
Well, I mean, one of my friends from school was at Johns Hopkins while it was being made, and he was like, you know, we this is our show, you know, everybody here loves this. This is the show we watch. This is the show we talk about. This is the show we line up around the, you know, to when it's being shot to be in the background, and you know, he said this is the authentic. You look at it, and it's, and this is what it looks like. One of my lecturers at university, they always felt the same way about Spencer's eyes. Like, I'm not particularly fond of the actors, but I'll watch it for Boston, you know.
You know, you were talking about the reality of the show a moment ago, and that reminds me of the story, and I think they put it into the episode, the documentary, which was the episode where Brody showed the squad what he'd been making of all the video he'd been shooting for the last year or so. And apparently during the production, I think it was of season three, the real Baltimore police chased two real drug dealers around a corner
into the set.
And right onto the set of Homicide. These two guys thought they were looking at real police and surrendered themselves to two actors.
It's hysterical. Absolutely brilliant.
And that just shows you, you know, that never happened.
They then put into
blue because they didn't look like real police.
True,
you know, but the thing is, there are two cop shows over the years that have always been given credit by police of a certain era for capturing what being a policeman felt like. One was Barney Miller, which they said perfectly captured the tedium of of the job, and the other was Homicide: Life on the Street, which captures everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
at least early on. So, yeah, and I also have to give a shout out right here before I forget to maybe my favorite moment in the whole series. John Polito's character, and there are spoilers here, Crosetti has killed himself. He is not going to be given full honors. No one is to show up dressed. Now, Frank Pembleton has always had problems with Crosetti, and he's a devout Catholic, and there's obviously going to be some issues with suicide. Who shows up dressed in his blues to salute Crosetti's body as it passes by, but Frank Pembleton? Hell of a moment.
They never topped it. They came close. They may have equaled it. They never topped that moment.
No. I mean, how can you? Seriously, how can you?
That's not an insult to anything else in the show. It's speaking to how powerful that moment is.
Yeah, it's like when we did, you know, when we did the Babylon 5 episode, and we mentioned, you know, two or three of the moments. You know, these are like the top moments. You can equal them. You just can't surpass them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, damn, it really was a hell of a show. I mean, it really, really, really was. So, I want to ask this question, and I'll go back to you, Aaron, and I will ask, what influences does the show have? And we kind of talked about that a little bit with Hugh, but I want to go circle back to that a little bit about for just a moment here. You know, and we talked about TV influences, if we can, but do you see anything outside of television, perhaps, that helped influence Homicide?
Well, David Simon's book, obviously.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, just there was in the early 90s, after Rodney King especially, the race conversation in America was finally, I think we were done doing the colorblind talk. We were done doing a melting pot talk. Okay, let's figure this out. Obviously, a lot of that has crumbled to dust again, and we're trying to rebuild a lot of that. But in the 90s, we were at one point, I think, trying to evolve. I think that this show was definitely part of that, whether it was, I think it was trailblazing in a way, but it was also following the zeitgeist in a way. It was really one of those brilliant pieces of art that can do both. It leading and following at the same time. It really pushes the envelope of what's okay to talk about, but it never quite pushes farther than the culture itself is ready to talk about. They pull it. That's, again, it's not a criticism. Oh, it is, but it's not like a damning criticism. When you're hitting as hard as you hit, if you pull back two or three times in the course of
120 shows, you can be forgiven. I do think it's one of those cases where it's not trying to push it too far while also trying to guide the conversation.
True. So, Hugh?
So I think influencers, I think one of the things, because we're talking about people who are big names, we've talked about all the popular stuff, but I think one of the things that really interested me at the time was the number of indie movie directors who you would shoot episodes and frequently come back and shoot more. I'm thinking of people like Mick Gomez, but also, McNaughton was not exactly a big name and hadn't made any blockbusters. Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer was probably what he was most famous for at the time. But Homicide would give him a new lease of life because he would literally take the entire crew with him in the hiatus one summer and go to Chicago and shoot Normal Life with Ashley Judd what's his name? Soap actor who killed himself eventually. Anyway, I think we can't, and also the choice of Mark Pellington to do the opening credits and the whole visual style that they went for. And we were talking about the smash cuts, which they became famous for, and we're talking about the editing and everything, and the style and the way they would compress time and alter perspective. I don't think we can underestimate Levinson's choice to push Fontana in that direction. You know what I mean? Because we could have easily ended up with just another TV show with the typical TV directors, right? And even
right.
The typical TV directors who worked on this show pushed the boat out. You know, there's people who worked on this show who I can remember years later being on stuff like Alias and whatnot, and they don't get to do anything half as interesting as they ever did on Homicide. And even the attempt to do a TV version of the 87th Precinct novels by McBain, they borrowed, four TV films, and the first one is entirely shot like Homicide. And I'm trying to remember if it was Bruce Paltrow who directed that or not. I think that's huge. I think the fact that the TV landscape, I think we've said already, was, and again, this is something I put in my original reviews, between Michael Mann and David Lynch, you were starting to see this, the wave was going, as you guys said earlier, cinema, I think, creators of cinema in television, doing things for television that hadn't been seen before, been done before, or if it had, not quite that way. And I think that's also something important. I think it was the right time in the right place. I think that's probably all that was missing.
Yeah. So now I'm going to ask this question. Fans and critics over the years have usually said Homicide was great its first three seasons. It was still pretty damn amazing in seasons 4 and 5, but it got more commercial. But seasons 6 and 7 are utterly terrible and garbage. I do not agree. I heavily do not agree. I think season 4 is really good. I think season 5 is really good. Maybe wobbles a little bit. I think 6 and 7 have the best character work and individual episodes of all those last 3 or 4 seasons. Particularly the introduction of Mike in season 7, the storyline with Bayless in season 7, and some of the individual episodes, like the one with Charles Durning as an old racist cop, bounty hunter from, not the bounty hunter, but the guy who was killed because of the legacy of his slave-catching ancestor, just some amazing stuff. But my question is, would you guys agree or disagree, and why or why not, in that those last two or three seasons are pretty much terrible? You know my opinion, so I want to get yours. Hugh?
Yeah, I hard disagree. I think you the passion that following the show had at the time, you know, there was a sense that, I mean, everyone knew that the show was under pressure, right? So I'm just going to take advantage of my original review quickly because it's right in front of me. So, you know, I mean, NBC basically effectively cancels almost like practically every year, right? And the renewal was always quite late, yeah? And so they renewed it.
You're going to make changes here. You're going to fix it up.
And they made a clear target, and they were said, you have to beat Nash Bridges in the ratings. This was for season six, right? That's what they were told, right? You, it was third in the time slot on Friday, and that wasn't enough. They wanted it to be on. They wanted it to be in the top, but they said they would accept second place, right? And this is according to Santana as well. And they were under the gun to produce more commercial TV, but obviously they've got that amazing team, and that's the year that Yoshimura and Simon become supervising producers alongside Jimmy Martin, right? So what you get is what I call the schizophrenic show. You know, you have these glossy episodes that are for the advantage of using large-scale Baltimore locales that have been opened up to them for bigger and commercial things, and you get more static camera styles and more conventional plots, and then you get episodes that are just as good as they've ever done, you know? And I don't think you can throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Just because it wants to try and, you know, be more, even when it's trying, the thing about Homicide is even when it's trying to be big budget and doing helicopter versus private jet in the opening episode, it's like they still do it the way Homicide does it. It looks more like, you know, I don't know, Steve Soderbergh or Paul Greengrass, the way they would do action later on, do you know what I mean? And then the moment they've got that out of the way, it's like, right, back to normal. You know, Nick Gomez, come on in, do your usual shooting, a nice, small, indie thing, you know. And there's just so many good episodes. I mean, season six has got the subway in it, for crying out loud.
Oh,
you know? And then you've got Closet Cases, right, where you've got the guy, the killer who's preying upon gay men, which pushes Bayless into a new area of self-exploration. You know, you've got Shaggy Dog City Goat with the white trash community in and around Baltimore. And then you get the criminally underused Cox, the ME, talking about all the bizarre cases. Something Sacred, looking at child abuse scandals in the Catholic Church, Lies and Other Truths, you know, Finnegan's Wake. I mean, just, oh, my God, so much stuff, right?
One with top. Yep.
That's it, the Buscemi one, yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah. Yeah, and they finally got Tony Lewis in on a more rotated into the squad and gave him more to do, which is great. Sadly, they wrote out Forbes, but, you know, as they said on the DVD extras, you know, the biggest mistake they ever made was not making Michelle Forbes one of the cops instead of the ME. You know, but then you've got the Captain Bigelow two-parter at the end. I mean, come on. You know, we're gonna throw out season six, you know, before we even get into season seven. I mean, yeah, season seven is the weakest of them, but it is so many episodes that just, you know, you just the fans are wrong, man. Like, as they often are. Fans are,
well,
yeah,
you know, fans,
that's why
fans are crunchy,
fans.
And they're called fans for a reason because they're fanatical, and some of them are purists. But, yeah, I fucking
precisely.
You know, love those last two seasons. You know, I think there's so much good there. You know, it's not a case like what you had with The West Wing, where somehow it won the Emmy for season four, which is where it started to fall apart. Then had a very schizophrenic season five, and the first half of season six is kind of average. Until, you know, that last season and a half where it really rounded into form again. This is a show that maybe wobbled here and there in seasons 5, 6, and 7, but never completely fell apart, at least for me. So what about you, Aaron? I know that you have a slightly different take because there's one season that you're not a big fan of, and I'm wondering what you're going to say about this.
Okay, so
if we're starting with season four, I think four is just as good as one through three. Honestly, it looks a little different, but I think it's every bit as good as one through three. Severe major issues. They forgot how to write Melissa Leo's character after she got the promotion to lieutenant. They just did not know what to do with her, and she was horrible. And it's not her fault. She was doing what they gave her to do. They were missing Bo that season as well. I did not like the
they were
Pendleton
all they're also missing
and
Isabella
Hoffman
character.
Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of people. The cast turnover was especially large from 4 to 5. I did not like the Pendleton recovery story. It dragged out way too long. Kellerman and his self-medicating in the bottle every night, trying to commit suicide in front of Lewis, and Lewis and him. There was some straight-up soap opera crap in season 5, and that has its time and place, but Homicide, for me, was not it. But then season 6 really bounced back. I do think 7 was probably a step back from 6, but 6 was a huge step up from 5 for me. And so I would still say 7 was better than 5. So I do think that largely the back half of the show is nearly as good as the front half. Just very real problems. I think there's one incredible episode. I do want to give credit where credit's due. One episode in season 5, which is Kadesh, where Munch goes to the funeral of his high school sweetheart, and you just see a different side of Munch. And that episode is truly remarkable. Other than that, truly, take it or leave it. I do think that it sets up the story of season 6, which is very good, and I think where you really start to see Simon's influence on the show, or the show's influence on Simon, one of the two, really take hold in becoming Simon would become after this show, with the sister seeking revenge on Kellerman and Lewis. I thought that arc made 5 worth it, even though 5 itself I can do without.
Yeah, and let's not forget that was also Mekhi Phifer having a nice little run on the show as a Junior Bunk. And Eric Todd Dellums, he didn't get in as many episodes as they seem to recall him being in, but probably because when you watched week to week, Luther's presence was always there. But Eric Todd Dellums is Luther Mahoney. Holy shit, got to give a shout out. That guy. We've talked about its influences. So what are the legacies? What is the legacy of this show, really? What has this show done? And I'll go back to you, Hugh. What is this show's legacy?
Okay, so this is where I've got in my notes. Everything Simon ever did since, because he learned to be a TV guy. Thank God for that, right? Specifically, on the corner, The Wire, and recently We Own the City, right? But everything. Fontana getting to effectively kick off HBO's drama strand with Oz, right? Because, that's where HBO, as we know it, starts, right? Clark Johnson becoming a TV director, the guy literally, he shot both the pilots and the finales for both The Wire and The Shield, right? Eric Overmyer, has been making Bosch for the last I don't know how long. you know, that's amazing. But the other thing I think that's amazing is the legacy. And sadly, most of my younger friends, when they watch love this show, have no clue about this, is Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Because Broga.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, he's just... It's
fantastic.
Like somehow, you know, transformed into this other thing. But it's got all those years of work as cops in Kojak and... You know, and even in movies, for God's sake, and Homicide, and he's getting to take all that and parody that, and it's there in his performance. You can see it; it's right there that he knows how to do this because of all that other stuff. And I love that's like a layer I can enjoy it in Brooklyn Nine-Nine that I know other not everyone can, and I just love that. So yeah, that's probably the greatest legacy, I think.
Well, you know, let's not forget John Munch and the fact that Richard Belzer has appeared on fucking everything, and
the
and,
Munch connection,
you know,
So I think that's probably it. I don't think it's been influential enough in the where I'd like it to have been. You know, I don't look at. Like even the good cop shows since then, like Southland and stuff, I still don't think anybody aspires to be like Homicide, do they? None of them do. They just,
And sometimes I wonder if that's because, you know, sometimes people are smart enough to look at something and say, yeah, we just can't do that. We're just going to go do our own thing. And if that is Homicide's legacy, getting people to try to do their own thing rather than imitate. Hey, that's
yeah,
not bad.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I mean, yeah, you mean look at the Shield, right?
Yeah, which, hey, you know, you mentioned Clark Johnson directed the pilot for that. He also directed Reed Diamond as a character in that pilot episode.
Yep. Oh, and yeah, I mean, there's just so much that these are the things I can think of that come out of it. But, the other thing with Diamond, by the way, I think the other great missed opportunity of the show that I haven't heard from the producers, but on the DVDs, which I think is they should have done a spin-off with Kellum and P.I.
Well, you know, had the ratings
I would
on
have watched,
the roof, maybe they would have.
Yeah, I would have watched that, man. I would have watched him walking, you know, like this Homicide-style shooting, but a P.I. in Boston. I would have watched him be that guy.
No, maybe you should have ended up in
anyway.
Detroit. And we had to deal with shit in Detroit.
That would be so funny. That would be so cool.
So, Aaron, what about that? What about you?
I mean, Munch was going to be David Simon. But Munch also seems like a great answer since he's been in literally every show made since Homicide. yeah, I tend to agree. I'm like its style. A lot of the shows that look similar to such a time that it's hard to say it was a true influence, because they would have been in production when before this aired. So like NYPD Blues, the later stuff maybe. But as far as like true like stylistic or thematic influence, I don't know how much it's been. I think the simplest answer to this question is The Wire, or David Simon, or however you want to say it. Like, I think that's the legacy of the show is that this is where he learned how to do what he does.
Yep. And now I'm going to switch to this one, and Hugh touched on this earlier, but is this ultimately a triumph of writing, acting, production, or directing? And now you can prepare to implode from the need to try to answer that impossible question for this one. So I will pause that first to you, Hugh.
Okay. I think writing first, then acting, then directing. And I think all of those three sometimes, despite the production, given what we were saying about the later years and the increasing pressure from the network. So, yeah, I think that's the order. I think I've read enough of the scripts. I think they're incredible. So I think that's where it starts. I think, as you said, that cast from the very get-go, and the fact that they couldn't cast anyone rubbish, even in a small role, right? I mean, I don't think Bruce Campbell's been better, you know, anywhere else, despite all the fun stuff that his fans love. It's that kind of show. So I think writing, then acting, then direction. Not to belittle the production, because we talked about how important Baltimore is and how local the show is, and the fact they got to shoot in so many places, and you can feel, you can practically smell the water, the seafront. It's just, yeah. So that's not to diminish the production. I just think that's the order.
Yeah. Well, my wife spent a long time in Baltimore, in and around that area, and you know, she, looking at the episodes of Homicide that I watched leading up to this, and when I did the same thing for The Wire, you know, she didn't just recognize it. She said, well, they actually, you know, aren't glamorizing it. They're like, just like letting it be what it is. And, you know, I think that's one you have to give them credit for, is not Hollywooding it. You know, they're just letting it be its own place.
Yeah.
So what about you, Aaron?
I'm going off book. I'm saying the direction. Because its visual style, I think, it brought cinema verite to television. And I don't think that can be undersold. We've talked about the jump cuts. We've talked about the gritty film stock. We've talked, like, these are all things that have kind of part of the grammar of telling as we've gotten more into this true blended era of cinema and television, where it's really hard to tell them apart in small samples. It starts before here, but cinema verite specifically starts here, and I don't think you can understand. I don't think you can write that into a script. And the actors are great, and the actors are doing. They're being directed by someone. They're being written by someone. And I don't want to. You know, undersell the cast itself, but no show is acting alone, you know?
No.
Except for Downton Abbey, somehow. but, you know, my answer for TV shows that really are great is almost always writing. And the writing here is top-notch. I cannot fault. I can't find a fault in Hugh's argument at all. But I do think that the writings or the directing stands out to me here because of the visual style and the visual signature of the show.
Yep. And, you know, because of this, I want to mention something. Barry Levinson was the producer on the show. He also directed two or three episodes. His last episode on the show was the season 3 finale, which could have been the series finale. It is called The Gas Man.
Mm-hmm.
It has Bruno Kirby, who had played young Clemenza in the Vito Corleone flashbacks from Godfather 2, as a man who felt he was wrongly imprisoned by Frank Pembleton something like 15 or 20 years earlier. And this is an episode that could have possibly been the final episode of the series. It sidelines all the other characters to focus on two characters we'd never seen before, this man and his friend, as they track Pembleton throughout his day in order to figure out the best way to kill him. It is well written, but it is also spectacularly directed. So, yeah, I'm glad someone gave a shout to the direction because, you know, but I also have to say, you know, Hughes not wrong either. I mean, you know, it's the directing, but it's also the writing, but it's also the acting. It's just, I mean, this is a really complete show, folks. But now I want to come to what's going to be our last big question here, and then we'll start to wrap things up, and that is, where does this fit in with the rest of the material David Simon would be involved with? We've kind of touched on that again, but, you know, not as much as I want to do here. So, Aaron.
I think there's a lot of Simon's themes being played with. I hesitate to say that, you know, it's his Rosetta Stone. I do think that's The Wire. I think if you watched nothing but The Wire, you would come out knowing exactly who David Simon is. But I think this is hinting at it. And that his fingerprints are on it from the start because of the book. But as I said, really, like, season six, he's really starting to settle into his own as a producer and as the sometimer on the show. And he started doing that towards the end of four and into five, but I really feel him settling in six. And so I do think that you're starting to see him, you know, massage television that he can get out of it. And just because of the nature of this show, you don't get the full brunt of Simon. A, it wasn't his show for so long. B, it's network TV in America in the 90s, and this is a man who thrives on content. He could not push the envelope in the way that he likes to do. But definitely is there. Like, his fingerprints are on it. It's just that it's not – it's his fingerprints on someone else's thing, you know? It's his book, and then it's Fontana and Levinson's. And then after a while, he's kind of starting to take that book back. Even though we're off book, you know, by the time he starts to take it back. And then you kind of see, okay, yeah, I can see where the guy who made The Coroner and The Wire came out of this towards the end.
So, Hugh, you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything to add to that. I think that's pretty much it. Yeah, I've got one word written down in my notes. I've got one word. It says seminal.
Yeah.
Yeah,
fair enough.
It all starts here. That's it. I got nothing else.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is as we were saying on our show a few years back, that Blog Talk unfortunately raptured us from finishing, you know, it all started with Homicide and his book and his time as a journalist, and who knows where it's going to take us, but I'm glad we've all been able to see this because, you know, it's not all Simon. Now, this show's obviously much more, in fact, other people, but, you know, this is not a minor work in the Simon canon. But it may be the most major work in the Fontana canon, and that's saying something. Being the Man also did St. Elsewhere and Oz, and what Oz became for HBO, you know. And now there's a show that, you know, without that show, hey, but look, without St. Elsewhere, we wouldn't have gotten Homicide. Without Homicide, we wouldn't have gotten Oz. Without Oz, we wouldn't have gotten The Sopranos. And Fontana kept bringing actors and writers and producers along with them. And then HBO sent some of those people over to, you know, Chase and Company at The Sopranos. And, you know, it all comes down from that tree. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I'd have to look it up, but didn't Tom Fontana come out of the Stephen J. Cannell tree along with David Chase? Or am I mistaken there?
Possibly. My brain is not functioning at this point.
Well, yeah, I know. And that's another reason I want to wrap this up, because some of you folks may not know, but Hugh is located in London. It is, what, 2:30 in the morning there now?
It is.
So, yes, we're trying to keep this short right now. Before we go into what I call housekeeping, and then the final question, the final short question, I'd be remiss not to say full spoilers right here. Season 3 ends with Ned Beatty's character and Daniel Baldwin's characters being written out of the show. We don't realize that, but it ends with them going away. And at the beginning of Season 4, we find out that their characters misbehaved at a convention and were suspended for the length of a TV season. A nice little meta joke there, Fontana and crew. At the end of Season 5, a body is discovered with its head blown off. That it ends up being Daniel Baldwin's character. Meanwhile, Ned Beatty's character has retired and turned his back on his former squad mates. This is all leading somewhere, because in Season 7, there was a vicious, vicious killer. And we see Bayliss pack up his stuff, and the next thing we know, the detectives are walking down the street in a reprise of the very first scene of the series, and they come upon the body of the killer that Bayliss could not quite catch in those last few episodes. And you pretty much know, oh shit, Tim killed him. Now, the previous season, because of the outcome of the Mahoney cover-up and everybody getting hurt, when the Mahoneys attacked the squad, Pembleton had left. Well, this is where we're at when the series was canceled. Homicide the movie comes along towards the middle of the next season to wrap things up. In it, Al Giardello is being Al. He is running on a pro-drug legalization platform. He's shot. And he dies. I'm telling you, spoilers. And at the end of the movie, Al finds himself in an afterlife where Crosetti and Felton, which was Baldwin's character, invite him to sit down to a card game, but there's another chair. And he says, who's the other chair for? And they say, well, you never know. Well, Frank ends up having to arrest Bayliss, who in the state of Maryland would probably be facing capital punishment for it. So is it going to be Bayless? Is it going to be someone else? How many other shows have the balls to do that? And how many other shows have had a satisfying a series wrap-up as Homicide had? Aaron?
I mean, not many.
Right. I mean, for me, it's up there in the top five.
off the top of my head, I don't know. The Deadwood movie didn't quite wrap things up as smoothly as I would have liked. Like, it finished the story, but there was a lot of, like, fan service.
Yeah.
With that, the Homicide, I mean, let's not, you know, the Homicide movie definitely has fan service in it, too. Let's not, you know, beat around the bush about that.
No, it does.
But,
it does, but it also manages
it feels,
to do a lot, right?
It feels a little more like an honest episode. But it was also a lot closer to the end of the show, whereas Deadwood was like 15 years later, and it's like, you guys have been waiting a long time for this. Let's do it right for you. You know, there's a lot of shows that either have the balls or the resolution. Let's be honest. In a Merylovision, leaving things open ended does take balls. You know what? I'm gonna stick recent for you here. The two best finales I've seen in a very long time belong to Better Call Saul and Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
They were both very daring. Atlanta.
Oh yeah.
Which were both very daring and satisfying to a point, but also left things up to the viewer to decide, you know, the truth. It's a special ending that Homicide had, you shouldn't undersell the movie because it is the end of the show. It is not a post-show fan service made-for-TV movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they did weird things with it just right there at the end, introducing, like, okay, so now it's gone into slightly Twin Peaks afterlife type stuff. Whoa. But that very much in keeping with what Tom Fontana did when he was on St. Elsewhere. I mean, St. Elsewhere is famous for its weird shit.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
So, Hugh, your thoughts on that finale?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you guys more. I mean, I've seen so many bad finales over the years. you know, going back to the 80s, you know, Magnum had a... Oh, God, yeah. They even brought back a character that should have... that they'd actually killed off, because that's how lousy a bunch of producers they were. You know, I mean, the Miami Vice one was so-so. Crime Story didn't really kind of peter it out.
Multiple Crime Story's ending sucked.
Yeah. God, most of the other shows just... Yeah, I mean, ER had so many false endings, do you know what I mean? It's like, it never really properly... Like, it should have ended when... what's his name? Anthony Edwards' character decides to leave, and because it's the handover from him to Noah Wiley's character, right? That was one point.
The sad thing about that is some of my favorite character moments came in some of the later seasons, but the best seasons were those first, like, five or six seasons, and then there was a lull, and then that season where they killed off Edward's character was a tick up before going back down.
Agreed.
And I honestly did like the last season of ER and thought the finale was really good. But no, I'll agree. It really could have and probably should have ended earlier. But, you know, 15 seasons?
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus Christ, that show ended up living long enough to influence Grey's Anatomy to the point where Shonda Rhimes actually got Grey's Anatomy on the air, and those final seasons were then influenced by Grey's Anatomy.
That's kind of crazy. There's a lot of recent stuff I haven't watched, including both of the ones Aaron mentioned. So it's not a TV movie though, but we've already did the podcast on it. But Person of Interest.
Person of Interest had a lovely finale.
Mm-hmm.
For closing off Finch's storyline that way.
Yep, exactly. And so I don't think there's many. I think the Homicide movie stands head and shoulders above most finales, wrap ups, and TV movies.
Yeah, it's a wonder for me. It really is.
Yeah.
I wanted to make this about 90 minutes, and we're at 100, so I do want to keep this quick. I am contractually obligated, as they say, to do this next part. This is what we call housekeeping, and that is announcing what's coming up next. Over the next few weeks, we are going to have a bunch of shows coming up on Deviant Legion. On the 29th at 8 p.m., Rock This Town Radio with TC, The Day the Music Died. At 2 p.m. on the 30th of January, a program simply called The Enchanted Kaleidoscope. On the 5th of February at 8 p.m., Rock This Town Radio will be back with TC, The Land of Lincoln, Illinois Rocks. That show will return 1 week later on the 11th at 8 p.m. with the No Mush Love Song Show, a.k.a. The Saturday Show. On the 14th, Down the Rabbit Hole with Rachel, Anti-Valentine's Music Mix. That's also at 8 p.m. And again at 8 p.m., Rock This Town Radio on the 19th of February with an episode titled Starts With The, Ends With Blank. Now, that's what's coming up over the next month or so for the rest of Deviant Legion. For this show, Cathode Ray Mission, we will be back on, we will be back on the 10th of February with a look at French director Jean Vigo, who only directed 4 movies totaling just under 3 hours, and yet he may be one of the most significant figures in the first 100 years of cinema. Join us for that discussion. 2 weeks after that, on the 24th of February, and you may be interested in this episode, Hugh, we will be doing a look at Batman the Animated Series. So that will be our February schedule. So now I'm going to I'll ask you this one, Hugh. Is there anything we haven't discussed yet that you'd like to touch upon briefly before we go?
Yeah, music. Because the original...
God damn! How did we forget that?
Yeah, one of the original production dictums was no music, except for, you know, no score, basically. And so it was one of the best examples of using, you know, chosen cuts, right? You know, from various bands and singers, and it just, you know, brilliant. And I was a big Garbage fan, and I will never forget them using I'm Only Happy With It When It Rained over Pembleton. Looking at the box, and I was just like, "Yeah, you guys know what you're doing."
I remember like when they introduced Luther Mahoney with Tom Waits' "Cold, Cold Ground" playing on a radio in the background, and you're like, "Oh shit!"
Yeah.
Or when they did a montage of Investigations to the Iguanas' "Boom, Boom, Boom." You know, just for example, the use of music in the show is amazing.
Yeah. So that's it.
Good catch. So what about you, Aaron? Anything that you want to bring up real quick?
Well, I want to mention, in terms of the music, that their use of Raining in Baltimore, which is my favorite Counting Crow song and is a truly perfect pop ballad, was my favorite musical moment in the show. As far as anything else goes, I don't think I have anything left to say. So we did talk about Bayless, an unfortunate, like shout out to Tim Bayless, who is actually the lead character of the show, that we went the whole episode without really mentioning at all.
Well, you know, let's take a moment here because this is interesting. He's one of the characters that NBC kept focusing on. They said, well, you got this young, and they were actually being pretty fucking racist. You got this young white detective. Why don't you focus on him? And why don't you put him into a romance that'll goose your ratings? Yeah, let him have coffin sex with this weird chick. That's literally what the one executive at NBC said. So that's how we got the Emma Zula storyline. And, you know, of course, Tim Bayless ended up, you know, the episode where, you know, we see Morse's character, where it's Tim's subtly racist cousin, and he's like, oh shit. And you just know they're never going to, that kills the kid on his porch, the Asian kid on his porch, and you that turns up to the wrong house, thinking it's a party. You know, then they do the sexual abuse story, and that you find out this is part of why Adina Watson's case bothered him so much, because of what he went through with his uncle, and how this affected his own sexuality, and Tim becoming one of the first bisexual characters on television. I mean, there had been some others, but, you know, as far as I can tell, he was the first regular one on a network show. I'm not going to count, you know, Ivanova on Babylon 5 as that, because that was a syndicated series. But I can't remember another one that was a regular and a lead at that, you know? So, yeah, I think that's important. So, yeah, I think good catch there, too. We definitely needed to get into Bayless a bit. And I do think that Kyle Secor often got overlooked. You know, he had a real thankless task, and I don't think that, you know, he ever did bad work. I don't even know if he ever got, other than the Zool story, really a bad storyline. That there was so much greatness. I mean, we could have forgotten Munch, and then all of a sudden go, how the hell did we do that? We didn't, but we could have, because it's just that type of a show. I mean, look, we've barely mentioned Crisetti, and John Polito was amazing those first 13 episodes with his Lincoln conspiracies and everything. Amazing show, just so much that we could talk about. But I do want to thank you guys for coming in. I want to thank everybody else for listening. This show was one of the first shows I planned when I very first got this show off the ground. And it's been delayed. We've tried to get it going along with the Kurosawa episode and one or two others that are in the pipelines. This is one of our longest gestating shows. So, yeah, I'm glad to get this one in the can. This was really satisfying. It's one of my favorite. It's one of my favorite shows. We do have to do a real quick question. Where do we rank this all time, real quick, guys? For me, it's my number 12 all time show.
Adam, you and your numbers. I'm going to say, because you know how much I hate this, if we're talking about cop shows, top three, if not number one, if we're talking about television, top 10 all time for me. Done.
Yep. And for you, Aaron?
I have this incredibly specific number because we were talking about it right before the show. Number 18.
Ooh.
Hey, not bad. Not bad. You know, and for me, it would be a little higher. It would be like around 7 or 8 if it wasn't for the fact that I also add in miniseries. But again, you know, I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank you two for coming in and participating. And on the count of three, we'll all say goodbye, and you can go finally get yourself to bed, Hugh. So thank you, everybody, and please join us in 2 weeks for the episode on Jean Vigo. 1, 2, 3... Good night, folks.
Good night.
Good night.